because within the jhana, the bliss is so dominant there that you don't really perceive any, right? All you actually perceive is incredible bliss. So if you ask anybody, when I exit from the jhana, what did you experience? And the main experience there is incredible bliss. That's so strong that you don't hear sounds, because you just bliss out, you can't hear anything. And the light takes you into the jhana, so it gets brighter and more brilliant, more happy, until the happiness takes over. Dear Ajahn, why is it necessary to abstain from eating after midday during our meditation retreat? Because the organizers are sadists and they want to have your difficult time. it's not always that necessary. What it was necessary for monks is out of compassion for you guys. So because the monks would go on alms round, they didn't want to keep bothering the people in the villages too many times a day. They just go on alms round in the morning and they take the food back and that'd be it. So imagine that, we keep bothering you not once a day, twice a day, three times a day. You get really fed up with monks always coming around asking for food all times of the day. But we did it once, just out of simplicity and convenience for you. That was all. But because it became part of being a monk, it meant that if you are staying in a monastery, again, you just have to eat at the monks' and the nuns' meal time. So if you stayed at a monastery, then also you would eat only in the morning time. And because in those days most meditation would be done in a monastery, meditation retreats were always associated with just living like a monk or living like a nun. So today when we have meditation retreats, again, even though it's in a hotel, we just eat in the morning time, not in the evening. It's not absolutely necessary, but you know what it's like, if you keep on eating, it just disturbs the whole evening, because eating is a social event. It's not just eating food, it's sitting around the table with the people you love and your friends, and you talk about this and you talk about that. That's why that when I go out to people's houses for lunch, because it's not actually a rule, it's just our habit, I never speak when I'm having lunch. I know one of you wants to sit next to me at breakfast, but I'm so used to sitting quietly by myself that you feel a bit uncomfortable. You just sit there and quietly eat it, and then you don't spend so much time eating. But even though that sometimes I eat one meal a day and don't have a breakfast at all, sometimes I finish my bowl of food in 10 minutes, 15 minutes. And the people feeding me, they're also eating half an hour and they're still not finished, and they're going to eat two or three more times that day. When you actually talk, the eating takes such a long time. You just eat mindfully with silently, it's over very quickly. Sometimes you go out with your loved ones for a dinner. How long does that take? Now, if you just went for dinner and just sat down by yourself, you put it in your mouth, ate it, digested it, paid your bill, quarter of an hour at the most. But sometimes 2 hours, 3 hours at a restaurant. Just the talking more than the eating. So that's one of the reasons also why we don't have the food in the evening, because it'd be impossible to keep your noble silence when you are having too much food. It'd be just too much socializing. So that's the reason why. And actually, in monasteries, it's very easy, because, well, in my meditation retreat centers, it's not a hotel. You don't see food, in the afternoon or evening. The trouble is here, you can see it, you can smell it, you pass the rest, you see all these other people eating. I wonder what they're eating. Well, I know it's really nice. That's the difficult part. It's best if there's no food at all, see, and then you wouldn't be so hungry. Here we go, a big blessing here. Sincerely thank you, Ajahn Brahm, and Singapore Buddhist Fellowship that brought Ajahn Brahm to Thailand. I went to some meditation retreat in Thailand. It is the first time to Ajahn Brahm's retreat. When I learned from Ajahn Brahm, I think there is something wrong in other Thai meditation teachings. Yes, they don't tell jokes. There is something wrong in other Thai meditation teachings. They focus on forcing body and mind to meditate many hours per day, very long chanting, and no Q&A session at all. For me, I found that comfortable body, relaxed mind brought more mindfulness and stillness. I got a lot of profound knowledge and more understanding from Q&A session.
I think prior Buddhist society should spend some meditation or time amongst to learn how to teach meditation from Ajahn Brahm. Maybe teaching meditation in Thai would be better and more interesting. Teaching meditation in Thai should have more kindness and compassion. That is the teaching of the Buddha. I think meditation teachers in Thai follow their teaching too much. I will join to Ajahn Brahm again if I have a chance. Thank you very much, signed Ajahn Brahm. That's very, very nice. I share, yes, it's not nice to be critical of others, but nevertheless, I think it's very true. Sometimes when we follow our teachers rather than thinking for ourselves, so please don't follow me. Think for yourselves, for goodness sake. Because if you think for yourselves, and then you can actually see, it doesn't make any sense being so strict. People get more tense, there's no kindness or compassion, which means that in the end people don't get sort of happiness and stillness, and they don't get jhanas and stuff. But what has happened, as you all know, in countries like Thailand, Singapore until recently, you follow the teacher far too much. Whatever the teacher tells you in school, you have to follow. It's wonderful to have respect, but sometimes respect goes a bit too far. Just because the teacher says it, it must be true. It's obviously wrong. Ajahn Chah never said that. He was unique amongst many of the Thai forest masters, because I remember I was there with him for the last 8.5 years of his life. When I went to Australia, it was only about a month or two afterwards, he had a stroke and stopped teaching. So I was there for the last 8 years of his teaching life. And one of the last similes he used to give was of the crab, the poo. And he said, this crab, he put his hand out and he sort of did a funny dance with his hand. He said, once there was a mother crab with a lame leg. And so when it walked very strangely. Because that's his idiosyncrasy, that was his character, had a bad leg. And so he told all his baby frogs, his sons and daughters, look, I only walk like this because I've got a bad leg. Don't you walk like that. But all of the sons and daughters of the mummy frog also imitated mother and also walked with a limp. And that's what he was saying, don't just follow the teachers. Now, if your teacher has a limp, don't each one of you walk with a limp. In other words, he was saying, yes, your teachers have a lot of knowledge, but don't imitate the 100%. The good teachings, yes. But then limpy teachings, don't follow those. Unfortunately, that sometimes in many of the Asian countries, we follow our teachers, we never think for ourselves. And that is shown by having no questions. You're not supposed to ask questions. But I still remember again, there was the first chairman of the English Sangha Trust, who was looking after the monasteries in England where our first monks went to. His name was George Sharp, and he brought his daughter to Thailand for her 18th birthday present. And so she went to see Ajahn Chah. Now she was an 18-year-old English girl. She wasn't a Buddhist. She just went there for a holiday. So she was more into boys and music than into Buddhism. And so when she saw Ajahn Chah, she really challenged him. She asked him tough words, that's rubbish, I don't believe with that, that's bullshit. Saying all those words to the great master Ajahn Chah. And her father was getting really embarrassed. You can't say that such things to Ajahn Chah. I said, no, let her, he said. And he said, I'm wonderful to have people like this, she's sharpening my knife. That's what he said, and I'm sharpening his wisdom. Because it's so rare have a Thai monk being challenged, especially by a young 18-year-old English girl. And she would do that because she had no idea of Thai culture. You're not supposed to do that. But no, come, more, give me more. I'm enjoying this. Because it's so rare to get challenged. And that was my experience teaching in Thailand. I remember I'd only been 2 years as a monk. I still couldn't teach Thai. Maybe a year and a half. And it was during the rains retreat, and the villagers insisted on listening to a talk from me. So I tried to make up a talk in Thai. No one understood, actually no one. But these women were going out, oh, sadhu, sadhu,
I've lived all my life and I've now heard a Dhamma talk by a Western monk. Oh, what great merit I've got. That was absolutely stupid, just because I was teaching gobbledygook, they couldn't understand it, they thought it was great merit. I remember another time I gave a talk to some people visiting from Thailand, and afterwards they all said, these were quite well educated people. They said, sadhu, 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 that's the first time we've heard a talk in Pali. You know, it goes, Thai. I was really disappointed. They again, they didn't understand a word of it. But even though they didn't understand a word of it, they all go out saying, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And then when they get out the door, how do the monks put it? That was a stupid talk. That was rubbish. I don't agree with any of that. But they never say that to the monk's face. Which is, I think, is a great, it's not very helpful to the monks, so we don't get any feedback. If I say anything stupid, you know, you write letters saying, catch up, wrong, I've never heard something so stupid in my whole life. Excellent. I can sharpen my knife as well. So it's great having questions and answers to challenge your teachers. I also remember once, one of the early times when I was in Singapore with the Buddhist Fellowship, and I was coming through, gave a talk in the evening, and after the talk I was catching the flight to London. It was a nice little break. And I remember Angie was driving me in the car with another guy, and there was a woman in there as well, because she wanted to have an interview with me. And it was the only time she could have, so on the way, I think I was in the Taiping Center, I think, you know, so there's a Lavender Road. And on the way to the airport, I said, well, what's the problem? And apparently she had a teacher from the Tibetan tradition who was teaching her that having sex with a teacher is a great act of merit. I said, is that right? Oh, come on, use your common sense. That's abuse, that's rape. You're just telling her that's no great merit for you to have sex with your teacher. I said, that's totally wrong, that's against the rules. Why didn't you ask and tell people? And I was really concerned that people believe in their monks and nuns without question, and they get into these very, very unpleasant situations. It's obviously wrong, but what really concerned me, why didn't she even ask? Oh, because a monk said it, it must be right. Please never think like that. Use your critical faculties. Whether it's a monk, a nun, a teacher, a priest, a pastor, just because they say it, doesn't mean it's true. And there's something so obviously untrue, but still we believe it. And that's what happens when you have unquestioning faith. Never do that, please. Anyway, good morning, Ajahn Brahm. Good morning to you. Must you get to fourth jhana to be enlightened? Is first jhana good enough? I think for you, yes. Just getting first jhana, I think, would be wonderful. But actually it is. First jhana is good enough. Can you explain the following and the differences and give examples? The stream winner, the non-returner, the arahat, and what it is to be enlightened. So the stream winner, the best simile of this, and I mentioned it in brief, is the story of the shipwrecked sailors. So apparently that was one of His Majesty the King of Thailand's favourite similes. But the first of the seven shipwrecked sailors, the first of the shipwrecked sailors, because he's done lots of bad karma, as soon as he touches the water, he goes straight down. Bad sailor. Second shipwrecked sailor, he's just an ordinary sailor, he's done some good things, some bad things. So he goes up and down, up and down, up and down, up and down, until eventually he gets tired and goes down and drowns. The third shipwrecked sailor is a really good guy. Now, always done charity, keeping precepts, helped out in the community, being forgiving, being compassionate. And because of his sila, his good virtue, he doesn't go down, he floats. He floats on the surface.
Victory, you keep your head above water for the troubles of life because of your virtuous conduct and your kindness, your generosity. And the fourth shipwrecked sailor is also, he's virtuous and done lots of compassion, good, so he's also floated. But he happens to look around and he sees dry land in the distance. He can see the grey outline of an island or a country, so he knows where to go to survive. That's called the stream winner. You see the garden, you see what the problem is, you see the solution, you know how to get out of the problem of life. And the next one, not mentioned down here, the once returner, is the one who's swimming towards the shore. And it never actually says when you started swimming, you're halfway or you're almost there. And that's why of all the four stages of enlightenment, the hardest one to pin down is the once returner. But the non-returner is very easy to pin down. That's the sixth shipwreck sailor. I mentioned this earlier, they're so close to the coast, they don't need to swim anymore, they can stand and just walk to the shore. I don't know if any of you have been swimming in the ocean, you know what it's like, you walk out so far then you start swimming. But that point where you, you know, start swimming until the point where you're walking in the surf, that's the anagam, the non-returner. You don't need to swim anymore, you're so close, you're just walking to the shore. And the arahat, you found safety, you're at the shore, no more problems anymore, craving done away with, you're at peace, sitting down at the shore, safe. So those are the shipwreck sailors. What it is to be enlightened, it is sometimes we know by what is missing, which is why when someone claims to be enlightened, they may claim to be enlightened, but monks we have our tests. We give them a test, not an examination on a piece of paper. It's nothing about intellect, it's about your emotional emotions and characters. So number one, you can't have any lust. So if somebody's really enlightened, sometimes you can give them a copy of Playboy magazine and you see what they do. If they get any lust at all, no, I'm sorry, you're not enlightened. Hey, or you may, the most unusual thing, you try and make them angry. So if a girl comes up to you, a Singapore girl comes up to you and says to the man, I say, it's impossible for women to become enlightened. You know, you have to serve the monks and maybe for your good karma you'll be reborn as a boy next time. See what they get upset. You try and stir them up as much as possible. And they really get upset. I'm sorry, you're not enlightened. It's not true. That's his total, you know, Gomayang. For those of you who want to know what Gomayang means, Go means bull, Mayang means a bad word for feces. So you know what it means, Gomayang. That's not true. Women get enlightened, everybody can get enlightened, there's gay people can get enlightened, it doesn't really matter who you are, kids can get enlightened, old people can get enlightened. So it's nothing to do with that, but I say that just to stir people up and to see what their reaction is. And if they're like, you can't say that, Ajahn Brahm, then I go, okay, you got angry, you're not enlightened. Sorry, pass it in. But one of those stories, and I love telling this story, so it's a story time here. There was a monk in China a long time ago, and he went to see his abbot and said, look, I really want to go for it in this lifetime. You know, I'm not really interested in anything else, I just want to meditate and become enlightened. And he said, look, I found this island not far away in the middle of a lake. Can you please give me permission to build a simple hut on the middle of that island? And all I would ask is that once a week you send a person over there with supplies, and I'll just, you know, fill up just simple food, nothing special at all, and anything else which I happen to need from day to day. Just once a week, that's all, so I can meditate in seclusion and silence and peace. So the abbot thought, yeah, why not? So he built himself a little hut, and the abbot arranged to send food and supplies over once a week. And after 7 years, the monk thought he was enlightened. And what did he do next? Now he's enlightened. He doesn't need to live on the island anymore. So the next time
The attendant rode over. The monk said, "Next week when you come, can you please bring over some parchment, an ink, and a pen? I want to do some calligraphy." So next week the parchment arrived with the ink and the pen. And then the monk put it in his room. He entered a very deep meditation. And when he came out, he wrote in exquisite calligraphy the four-line poem. The diligent monk, alone for 7 years, is no longer moved by the four worldly winds. Now in Buddhism, the four worldly winds, not being moved means you're enlightened. It's just one of the ways of describing it. You're not moved by praise and blame and grief and all these other things which happen in life. You're totally unmoved. He was claiming enlightenment. So the next week when the attendant came, he gave him the parchment and told him to deliver this to the abbot. And then he relaxed. The next week the answer came. The attendant gave this monk another parchment, very similar to the one he'd given to the abbot. He said, "This is from the abbot." And he quickly opened it up. Actually, it was his parchment. And over the first line of the poem, written in exquisite calligraphy, the sort of calligraphy you'll find in the museum, so well done. Over the first line, the diligent monk, was written the four letters in red biro pen. F-A-R-T. Far. And the next line of the poem, alone for 7 years. The same four letters, but this time in capitals. F-A-R-T. Fart. And the third line of the poem is no longer moved. This time, big red F-A-R-T underlined. And the last line of the poem, by the four worldly winds. And then a bigger F-A-R-T underlined with three exclamation marks afterwards. He had ruined his calligraphy. He thought that expression of enlightenment by a famous monk would one day be hung in a great museum, or if it was today, be auctioned by the Buddhist Fellowship to raise funds for something. But there it was, ruined by the stupid abbot who had scrawled four naughty words over his exquisite calligraphy. And this monk was so upset, he ran to the bank. He called the attendant back and said, "Take me to that abbot, that stupid abbot that doesn't know enlightenment when it's in front of his face. And he's so uncouth, he's spoiled this amazing calligraphy." So the attendant rode in over the lake and he went into the monastery. He stormed into the abbot's office. He threw the piece of paper on the table. "Explain yourself, abbot!" He was so upset. And the abbot slowly rose, opened up the scroll of paper and read out the poem. "So, monk, the diligent monk, alone for 7 years, is not moved by the four worldly winds." That's what he wrote. "And yet my four little farts have blown you clean across the lake for the first time in 7 years." And the poor monk is, "Oh God, I've got enlightened." So he trudged back and stayed another 7 years on the island. That's what we usually do. We try and upset people when they say they're enlightened. If you come and say you're enlightened, we'll say, "You stupid idiot. Who do you think you are? Absolutely not. No way." And I'll try and really upset you. "Actually, I shouldn't tell you these tricks." "No, I can't. I've got some water anyway." And so a person gets enlightened, gets angry, they're not enlightened. That's what enlightenment is. People can call you the stupid Kuai Lo monk. Kuai Lo, and I know what it means. And say, "You're absolutely, absolutely stupid. No way can you ever be enlightened." Try and upset a person. And if you're just quite happy, "Okay, I'm Kuai Lo, I'm stupid, I'm a fat monk, I'm ugly, I tell terrible jokes, yes, yes, yes.
I don't care, that's your problem, not mine. Then there's a good chance you're at peace. Okay, I'm going to carry on with these questions. Great Jabron, can you enlighten us? I've been trying to do it all week. Can you enlighten us on how to meditate on death? Yeah, first of all, die. Then meditate on it. You know, live in the present moment. So are you dead yet? If you're not dead, how can you meditate on death? Live in the present moment. Anyway, I read someone, Ajahn Chah, recommended this to be done 3 times daily. It's like taking medicine before breakfast, lunch and dinner. Also, can Ajahn Bhampis tell us how to meditate on curing skin diseases? You spoke about it earlier during this retreat. You just meditate. And not all diseases cure themselves. They just meditate, become peaceful, become kind, in the present moment, doing nothing. You're watching the breath go in, the breath go out, delightful breath, delightful, like a band leader. Those band leaders they used to have in the old days, the fly on band leader. Breathing in, everybody breathing, everybody. So get nice and peaceful, nice and happy, you see beautiful lights, you get into jhanas, when you come out of jhanas, these things are gone. That's how it works. You're not meditating to cure the diseases. You meditate just to be kind, peaceful, gentle, and the diseases heal themselves. How to meditate on death. Being serious now, I said this to people, I think, at the first half of the retreat. If you haven't done this yet, this is a wonderful way to meditate on death while you're doing walking meditation. Remember I told you to walk in meditation, start at one end of the path so you can be aware of your left leg moving, right leg moving. There's a moment of awareness, silence, just watching your legs moving. Then the full awareness of the left leg moving from the first time it lifts off the floor till the last part of the foot which touches the floor, watching the weight go from one leg to another, the right foot starts to move. The full awareness of the walking. You can take it even as far as like the delightful breath of delightful walking. Just so happy just walking, nice and peaceful, nice and happy. That's as far as you can take the walking meditation. But if you want to do death meditation, you do a little mantra as you are walking. When your left leg moves, you recite to yourself, I will die. When your right leg moves, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. I will die. If you're tired, your left foot moves, die. Right foot moves, meh. Die meh, die meh. Nightmare means for certain. So if you do that while you're walking, I will die, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. At first you think it's a joke. The next stage, you realize, this is no joke, this is for real. There's many things that you just take on trust and believe, rebirth, nirvana, whatever, but at least you know you're going to die. That's 100% certain. That really starts to say, wow, this is actually true. So from having fun, to seriousness, then the next thing which comes up is fear. I'm going to die, that's for sure. You really are going to die. That's for sure. You get fear. You carry on going, and after you go through fear, you let go. I'm going to die, so why am I worried so much about all this stuff? My reputation, my possessions, my family. You detach. So I will die, that's for sure. You go through those 4 stages. When you get past the fear stage, and you really let go, oh, you're just having such a peaceful, wonderful time. Like all the burdens have vanished for you. You realize it's like being dead. You have no family. You only do with the family. You don't own them. You've got nobody to worry about. No real concerns. No financial problems. No social problems. Nothing. You're going to die. That's the relief. So try that. I will die, that's for sure. It's really good fun. Gurukha, does it mean that the more you meditate, the faster you reach the jhanas? Yes and no. In other words, meditating a lot increases your chances, just by the more lottery tickets you buy, the more chance you're going to win the lotto. But it also means the quality of your meditation too. And as the quality or the quantity, actually the quality is most important. So if you meditate hour after hour after hour after hour, but the quality is low, 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 then you're not going to get a chance. But sometimes you just meditate with high quality, not so much as others, you can get the chance, because it's quality, more important than quantity. How do I help a loved one who does not love himself? He continues to waste his life away without any purpose, motivation in life, disregarding his own health, his life, and his loved ones. That's very difficult to help somebody else when they don't like to be helped. Now you, they always say that you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it drink a cup of tea. It's great when you take old sayings and you change it a little bit. It makes it very profound, doesn't it? What does that mean? I don't know, I just made it up. You can't force a person to do these things. However, there are some little tricks, some psychological tricks, to try and get them to actually to understand some Dhamma, to love themselves and to stop wasting themselves. That's a big ask. But at least you can get them on the path for that. And so one of the stories which I tell is of this, I think, Malaysian girl who really got a lot out of listening to these talks and meditating. But she had an Australian husband who preferred watching the football and going to the temple. And when he did have any religion, it was the religion of the bottle of beer at the pub. That was his church, a temple, the pub on the Friday or Saturday night. So he spent a lot of time in there. When she started talking religion, he would certainly turn off straight away. So she said, look, I know he would enjoy going to the temple and listening to all this stuff, but I just can't get him to come here. So this was a trick I suggested. I've used it many times. It actually works really, really well. I said, buy a copy of my book, Open the Door of Your Heart. Take it home. And as soon as you get home, tell your husband, keep your hands off this, it's mine. That's what it means to do to Australian husbands. Keep your hands off this, it's mine. And he got quite offended. What do you mean? He said, look, it's my book, leave your hands off this, it's my religious book, okay, leave it alone. And of course, you know the psychology of men, especially Australian men. When she was out shopping one day and he was home, what does she mean I can't look at her book? So he started looking at it. He read the first story and did put it down till he's finished. Now he comes every week. I said, that's hard to do it. Bit of reverse psychology. You know, just tell him, you know, look, yeah, no, you really are a sort of stupid person. But, you know, this book is way beyond you. Or, you know, no way can you ever read this book. What is some reverse psychology? You know, say you're banned from reading this book. Or whatever. But leave it around. Because if you say that to someone, you cannot read this book. Because what do you mean? I want to read it. It's just like when I was a kid, we used to have X-rated films in England. And I must admit, they're with my friends. I was just a boy, you know, we tried to sneak in, even though you were underage. And I remember going into one of these X-rated movies, and it was so boring. You know, but you had to go and watch it because it was prohibited. If they'd made it, you know, open...
No, I would... No, I must be part of meditation. No, I would watch it. But because it's prohibited, you have to look at it. The best way of marketing is to ban a film or ban a book. So I think that if we can...
Actually put, say, in my latest book, After Disappearing, can we put it X-rated? Then the sales would go up for sure. So sometimes that's one of the things you can actually try and do. Make it easy, so leave books or CDs or whatever around the house. So just because sometimes it's boredom, they'll pick it up and have a look at it. Guru Sajjan Brahm, is Buddhism a religion or an education? I was asked that question on national radio about a month ago. My answer was, Buddhism is a religion in Australia for tax purposes. So, but it actually fulfills many of the things which describe religions. So yeah, it's a religion. It's also an education, it's also a philosophy, it's also a way of life, it's many, many things. My friend told me that, the Lord, Krishna is the highest amongst Jesus, Buddha, Allah, etc. Thanks for your wisdom. No, my Lord and Master is the higher than your Lord and Master. My God in heaven is more powerful than your God in heaven. So to think that, you know, that all the different gods, that Jesus, Buddha, Allah, Jehovah, they all have a competition to see who's more powerful. Well, that's stupid. But anyone who says that my religion is the best, that's called conceit. They never actually say that. That my religion is the best. It's just truth is the best. Love is the best. Kindness is the best. Humility is the best. Rather than actually saying religion. Have a blissful Saturday morning. Cheers. Yes, that's my plan. How did you know I had a plan to have a blissful Saturday morning? Apart from that. I would heart felt thanks, Lord Krishna. That would have been my Lord Krishna. Next question. Your nothingness. That's a very nice way of calling me. Yes, I appreciate that. Your emptiness, your nothingness.
I'm sorry,
Lord Krishna, please keep the lights on. As I watched the breath, I could feel water dripping down my chest and the back of my neck. My roof must be leaking. And if it's outside, there must be a bird pissing on it. It does happen. Imagine sitting under the Bodhi tree all night. I know if it's some of the Bodhi trees in Australia and all these birds sitting up there, you know, doing what you might get on your head in the morning. Anyway, as I'm watching the breath, I can feel water dripping down my chest and the back of my neck. It goes for some time. There's a genuine sensation on the feeling is underneath my skin, so I'm not getting wet or anything. What is going on? Okay, that's another one of those experiences where your perception is starting to do strange things. It's just how it feels. What is happening is your perception is being so controlled. You can only see things in a certain way. You can only experience things in a certain way. And when you're letting go, basically you're giving freedom to perception to do weird stuff, to play around, to mess around, to feel things which cannot be true, to see things which cannot happen. It's just perception, just messing around. You're not going crazy, you're not becoming schizophrenic, you're not becoming mad, it's just what happens, you just enjoy it. Interesting. Weird experiences, because sometimes meditation, just watching the breath, can be a bit boring. And to feel water trickling under your skin. Oh, that's really interesting. And trickle a little bit over here, please. Just a second. Thank you. You have fun with it. And then it's not fearful. And it just disappears after a while. So that's quite part of the course. In Sutra, I read many stories that some people just listened to Buddha's teachings. They became arahant, enlightened. I think they did not even get jhana or meditate. Is it necessary to meditate and get jhana to become enlightened? Is it possible anyone who is sitting here and just listening to Ajahn Brahm get enlightened? Did it happen to anybody? They're quoting this story of Bahia, who went to see the Buddha, and the Buddha said, Bahia, listen very carefully. In the scene, let there just be the scene. In the herd, let there just be the herd. In the sense, which means smell, taste and touch, let there just be the sense. And in the known, what you see with your mind, let there just be the known. And after that teaching, Bahia was another arahat. It worked, he became an arahat, and that's exactly that teaching. So how many of you became an arahat just now? Why didn't it work for you? It worked for Bahia. The reason was that Bahia was keeping precepts, was being meditating. When you see his history, he'd been meditating a lot. He had psychic powers and the whole works. So that was the straw which gave the last piece of the jigsaw puzzle. And just like many, many stories, we don't give the whole story, we just get the finale. Like going to people's houses, you see the picture of when they get their degree, you know, at the university. I've never seen the picture of them doing their homework. or doing their exam. They only have the picture, it's the final moment when they get their degree. So according to that information, to get a degree, all you need to do is to dress up in a suit and one of these gowns and funny hats and just wait until the person calls your name, and then you get this bit of paper and then you've got your degree. That's how you get your degree, isn't it? Because I've seen people get their degree that way. So that must be all you have to do to get your degree. Because we don't show all the preparations which went before that final moment. The same with Bahia, we don't show all those hours and days and years of meditation and keeping precepts which went before that final moment. So you do need to do much more than just listen to suttas. If the only suttas you needed, you would have become enlightened a few moments ago. But if you had just attained a jhana, your mind was very clear, and I said that, maybe it would have happened. If you prepare, then we're ready. Dear respected sir, is it possible to get reincarnated as an alien? That'd be cool. Because, you know, it's a waste of time in this earth. I mean, being a human being again, being there, done that, being an alien with tentacles. It'd be really cool to have a few tentacles, you know, and have like three eyes instead of two, so I can turn this way and that way. So wouldn't it be really cool to be an alien? You reckon? We'd like to be an alien. But in alien world, we'd like to be a female alien or a male alien, or the aliens, they just have sex with themselves like some species do. Would that be fun? I don't know. So when you want to be an alien, you don't know what you're letting yourself in for. But you know there are such things as aliens. Have any of you ever gone to Heathrow? At Heathrow you see EU citizens, you go through one channel, and aliens, you go through another channel. I've seen that. That's what happened there. So it's very interesting, when the first time I went to Heathrow after being in China for such a long time, I saw there's no aliens. I was looking there to see if there's anyone with tentacles. So I'm going to call it aliens. That's just anyone who's not English. This just shows you how the English are. That is, yes, it's possible to get reincarnated as an alien, maybe. I know this sounds ridiculous, but the fact is that our body is made up of hydrogen, oxygen, carbon, nitrogen, silicon, and others in that order. Some of your bodies, my map is made up of hydrogen, oxygen, carbon, tea. English bodies have got tea up there somewhere. The abundance of elements in the universe is hydrogen, oxygen, carbon, silicon, nitrogen, and others. Considering that from an astrophysics point of view, the Earth is not really that special, as there are billions and trillions of planets in the universe. I think it would be arrogant to think life exists on Earth, as our constituencies are everywhere. What are the Buddha's take on this? Thank you very much. Exactly, the Buddha said. One sutra in the Anguttara Nikaya, yeah, there is life on other planets. It's amazing, 26 centuries ago. He said there's many world systems, and some world systems have their own beings, separate to the Earth. So even the Buddha acknowledged that. Incredible just how way ahead of his time he was. So the Buddha believed in aliens. That's really cool, isn't it? So any of your young people are really, you know, into aliens. So yeah, Buddhists are, we accept aliens. So if you want to be a religion which, you know, accepts aliens, you know, join the Buddhist Fellowship. I know you've got a special group in the Buddhist Fellowship for the Indonesians, so you may have like a subgroup for aliens in the Buddhist Fellowship. Buddhist Fellowship Alien Group. Dear Ajahn and fellow students, for those with stiff backs and aches, try spending more time in the body awareness stage before beautiful silence. Feel the calmness of heat energy going to the aches. It works incredibly well for me. Thank you. Yeah, it does work. So if you've got really an ache here and a pain there, just be aware of it in the body awareness and then just give it lots of kindness. And it all sort of gets really hot and nice. Good Ajahn Brahm. After the last meditation retreat, I found that my temper took a turn for the worse. Then I stopped meditating. What should I do? You're back here again, so it's going to get even worse next time. So what you can do is you can actually Maybe get the mask and tape around your face for the first few days after you go back to work. Maybe not. I'm not quite sure what retreat and why the temper took a turn for the worse. Maybe it was always that bad, but now you're mindful enough to really notice it. That's more likely. Because usually the path for the course is that after meditation retreat your temper is fine. In fact, you're such a nice person afterwards. But when you go back home, your wife asks you, when's the next retreat, darling? I'm sending it on you sending you on the next retreat at my expense again. Because you're a much nicer husband after you've been on these retreats. That's what usually happens. We're not quite sure what's happening there. Last question. Maybe the real reason is because after the retreat is finished, you're so upset that you can't meditate anymore. You've got to go back to work. And that's really a downer. So maybe your temper is because of the suffering of having to leave this wonderful retreat with this nice, warm and cuddly monk who tells silly jokes. I don't want to go. And so that increases your temper. That's one of the reasons why I prefer people to take photographs in the middle of the retreat rather than the end of the retreat, because at the end of the retreat, when people take photographs, people always feel sad. And you say, please smile and say to you, I can't do it. The retreat's over. So you all get sad photographs. Does one merit or make merit offering dana to meditating lay people and non-meditating monks? That's really an interesting question. Do you get more merit offering to like a lay person who say an anagami? The offering dana to scallywag monks? Really good question. You may have got a point there, maybe. Because sometimes the dana is being wasted. They do actually say that the dana is purified by three things. It's purified by the donor, that's your intention. You're doing it not expecting to get anything back in return, not expecting to get favors, you're just giving a donation. It's also purified by the recipient. In other words, if it really is a good person or a good monk, then that means you get much better merit. If it's a scallywag monk, then they defile the donation. And it's also the intention as well in between. There's a third thing which is purified by. Purified by the donor, by the intention, by the recipient. So it's saying that the bad monk and the good lay people. And it's very hard to say which is the better merit, but it's certainly merit is diminished enormously if the recipient, monk, nun, lay person, is not a good monk or lay person. So that, but how do you know? So how do you know is actually, check out, just because a monk or a nun or a lay person says amazing things, they give really, really powerful teachings, or they look just so peaceful and still, it could be an act. So the best thing is to check them out for a long period of time, first of all. And that's one of the reasons. In Bodhidharma Monastery, if you come for the Katina time, or the Sarvaraja retreat, one of the rules is there is you can go to any monk's hut and have a look around. The doors of my huts are open, actually just most of the year they're open. So you can go in there, see if you can find the copies of Playboy magazine hidden under the mattress. There are none. So yes, you can see just how monks live. This is my private quarters, they're not private. Have a look around, I've got nothing to hide. So you can actually see how I live. And it's wonderful, like, to be totally open. Have nothing to fear, nothing to be ashamed of. So you can go and have a look around and see whatever. And even now, people are probably in my room in the hotel, looking around to see what I've got. There's nothing there. Just, you know, my old robes and stuff. But it's nice, actually, not to have to hide anything. So that's always a good sign. It'd be wonderful if all monasteries had their doors open. So you can go into the monks' rooms and see how they live. Then you get to know if they're good monks or not. Can I go in your room and see what you've got? Oh, I jump along, all my secrets, you'll find out. No, so that's a good monk. So that's the good monk to actually to support. actually a good temple to support. Okay, it is now 11 o'clock, so if you want, please do have a toilet break, have a quick toilet break, and in a couple of minutes time we'll do some meditation before lunch, to the 11:30 lunch coming soon. If you're leaning against the wall, you can put your legs out if you wish, as long as you're comfortable. When you are ready, you close your eyes. And please forget about all the stuff I've said over the last hour and a half or two. So if anything useful is stored inside, you don't have to try to remember them. So let go of the past, we don't run off to the future. So time for peace, for quietness, for silence. A time for just being. At the end of this meditation, those of you having a good time, you can carry on. I mentioned to a few people yesterday that the solar noon is at 12:26 right now, 26 minutes past 12. So you have until that time to finish your lunch. You've got plenty of time. You don't have to finish at 12 noon, because that's only the other clock. The real noon, the time when monks have to stop eating, here in Kowloon today is 12:26 p.m. Remind yourself this is meditation time. So for the next half an hour, I'm going to let go. It's not the time for doing business. It's not the time for planning. It's the time for letting go and being peaceful. No expectations, no desires. When I want something more, I can't enjoy what I already have right now. So whatever you have right now, enjoy it. Don't want anything more. And that enjoyment will grow and grow and grow, all the way into jhanas. Don't want anything more.
to mouth. That means what's three mercy outbursts. And then do that outburst come out in meditation.